Lectures. He is here as a Cecil and Ida Green lecturer, coming to us from Tulane University, where he is spending the fall semester as a visiting professor. I could obviously go on about his accomplishments at some length, but I think it suffices to say that someone who knew I was associated with the Institute stopped me in the hall this week and said, "Is the gentleman who will be speaking on Saturday night the Dr. Janssen?" I am able to assure you that he is indeed the Dr. Janssen, and it is a great pleasure to introduce him.
Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope I know how to work this system here. I thought I'd introduce my subject pictorially rather than by a theoretical definition. What you see on the screen are the first two frames of a three-frame cartoon sequence that appeared some 15 years ago in the New Yorker magazine. The painter here is obviously taking a chance. What could be the result of his action? For he is obviously an action painter, to use a term we all know from recent art criticism. A big splash of some sort, we might suppose, but no. Now, it seems to me that what makes us laugh here is not the unexpected creation, or rather recreation, of a picture that has become a visual cliché. The nub of the joke is the action painter's discomfiture. Clearly, he expected to see a painting that looks as if it had been made by chance, but fate has played him an unfair trick, and his faith in the efficacy of his technique seems badly shaken. The ironic implications of the cartoon actually go a good deal further than we might think. There is, first of all, the fact that it was Whistler who was accused, probably earlier than any other painter in the history of art, of having flung a pot of paint in the public's face. He sued the author of this remark, John Ruskin, for libel, and bankrupted himself in the process. We shall return to this trial a little later, and we shall see that Ruskin's statement, although a gross oversimplification of the way Whistler actually worked, was not altogether unfounded. The artist himself admitted that he sought out and utilized chance effects, and the flinging of paint, as depicted in the cartoon, is not too far from some of the technical innovations of abstract expressionist painters such as Jackson Pollock. I'm showing you an example just to recall his style to your mind. Jackson Pollock, who often worked by pouring or dribbling paint on the canvas. While his method does not permit as precise a control over the shapes produced as the traditional brush, it has important virtues of its own. And one of these is that it minimizes the likelihood of a representational image being created inadvertently. For paint, thus aimed at the canvas, has an independent dynamic that is lacking when the artist merely carries pigments to the picture on the tip of his brush. Now, the inadvertent creation of images is not as far-fetched an idea as you might think. Françoise Gillot, the former mistress of Picasso, tells a story that fits this context, and she has it from the artist's own lips, although it happened back in 1911 or 12, when both Braque and Picasso were working very closely together in creating the Cubist style, a very austere and rather abstract style at the time. Well, one day, Picasso visited Braque in his studio, and Braque showed him his latest work, and Picasso said, "What's that squirrel doing over there?" Braque was rather taken aback and said, "What squirrel?" And Picasso pointed it out to him. He said, "Yes, by God, that's right. There is a squirrel which shouldn't be there." So he promised to work some more on the canvas to get rid of the squirrel. So the next day, Picasso returned, looked at the canvas, said, "I still see that squirrel." And it was only on the third try that Braque succeeded in getting away from the unintended squirrel. But let us get back to our cartoon. Another, and perhaps even more intriguing, aspect of it is that it reflects an anecdote told as early as the 4th century before Christ, and repeated countless times ever since. Our earliest source for the story is Pliny, who must have learned the story from a Greek source, since it concerns the Hellenistic painter Protogenes. That artist, so the story goes, once tried to paint the foam issuing from the mouth of a panting dog, but did not succeed until, in a rage, he hurled a sponge at his panel and by sheer chance achieved the desired effect. Yet chance, in the modern sense, as an uncontrolled, random event, was hard to conceive for the ancients. The word used by Pliny and others in telling this story is fortuna, good fortune. And it, or maybe I should say she, was a deity, or at least an active force, whose workings were explored in great detail by a number of ancient authors. Characteristically enough, references to the sponge-throwing painter and similar tales are most often found not in the literature dealing with art, but in treatises dealing with fortuna, divination, or related topics. The implication of the Protogenes anecdote is that an image made by fortuna does not happen to just anybody. It is a sign of divine favor, or as we would say nowadays, of genius. In other words, chance is equivalent to inspiration. Such a view is hardly surprising. The idea of chance as mere randomness is of fairly recent origin and remains difficult to grasp, except, I suppose, for mathematicians. To primitive man, there can be no such thing as a random event. Whatever happens must have significance, however well hidden, whether it be a flight of birds, the conformation of the liver of a sacrificial animal, or a face among the clouds in the sky. This matter of the flight of birds survives in our language in the word auspicious, which comes from avis and speaker. That is, you look at birds in the sky and that they fly the right way, then it's a good day to sign that contract, or whatever it may be. So an auspicious event is one that has been sanctioned by the birds flying in the right direction. We all know how strongly this attitude survives today. We find it on the level of ordinary superstition, which may attach itself to anything from tea leaves to astral bodies, but it also survives among the sophisticated, those who have drunk too deeply at the Freudian well, tend to attribute every traffic accident to an unconscious death wish, and to find deeply revealing unconscious images in the works of psychologically interesting artists such as Leonardo da Vinci. Not long ago, an Italian scholar of considerable repute claimed to have discovered such an image, namely a death's head, nestling among the folds of Michelangelo's Pietà in St. Peter's, and he commented at length on its symbolic meaning. The photograph he reproduced, taken at a peculiar angle and under unusual lighting conditions, did indeed show something which might be interpreted as a skull, but other pictures of the famous group failed to show it. And it just so happened that that year, the Michelangelo Pietà was shipped and exhibited in New York at the World's Fair, and I had the privilege, along with a number of my colleagues, of spending 2 hours after the closing of the fair, in which we could inspect the piece in our leisure, and there was no trace of that skull. Apparently, in this instance, the drapery patterns of the statue serve the same purpose as the ink blots of a Rorschach test, and the supposed death's head relates to the state of mind of its discoverer rather than to that of Michelangelo. The belief in the significance of chance has also had a survival, or better perhaps a revival, in modern art. When Hans Arp, one of the founders of Dadaism and Surrealism, speaks seriously and eloquently of the muse of chance, or gives his works such titles as Objects Arranged According to the Laws of Chance, he too equates fortuna and inspiration. As an intermediate link between ancients and moderns, I might cite the French philosopher Montaigne, to whom chance and genius seem closely associated in both poetry and painting. Those poetic flights, he writes, that carry the author beyond himself, should we not attribute them to his good fortune? He himself will admit that these flights surpass his capacity, that they come to him from outside himself, and that he has no control over them. The same happens in painting. It too sometimes escapes from the artist's manual control, surpassing both his knowledge and his conception, so that he is amazed and filled with admiration. And then Montaigne tells the Protogenes anecdote as a classic example of this phenomenon. There is nothing strange, then, about the ancients equating chance and genius. Their belief in fortuna as a mark of divine favor was so well established that Roman generals or emperors often chose the nickname Felix, lucky. And the same might have been true of certain ancient artists, on the basis of experiences like the sponge-throwing incident of Protogenes. Perhaps they were the ones whose unfinished pictures, according to Pliny, were sometimes even more admirable than their finished works, because they still showed the lines of the original sketch and thus revealed the workings of the artist's mind. Although exceptional, as Pliny admits, such appreciation of spontaneity, of inspired groping as against technical polish, is but a step removed from the chance-genius equation exemplified by the Protogenes anecdote. I have cited these passages in order to establish that the notion of a link, mysterious but real, between chance and artistic creation is well anchored in our cultural tradition. But what bearing does this have on artistic practice? Did ancient artists actually solicit or exploit chance effects? The visual evidence available so far is extremely scanty, perhaps because the monuments have not yet been systematically examined from this point of view. Still, we do find at least a hint here and there. It has been noted, for instance, that the crowning ornament of acanthus foliage on certain Greek grave steles suggests a human face. And here you see one. The effect is so unobtrusive that it could hardly have been planned. Yet, at some point, Greek sculptors must have become aware of the physiognomic quality of these designs and developed it into more clearly recognizable leaf masks that became part of the established repertory of classical art. Here is an example a couple of hundred years later from Baalbek, where, of course, the mask has been planned from the very start. but it still looks like a sort of chance configuration of foliage. The tradition of such masks can be traced in countless examples throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. Let me show you a Gothic specimen. This comes from the base of a very famous piece of medieval sculpture, the Bamberg Rider. And we have now seen that the mask can look back upon a tradition of at least 1,000 years from that point on. Unlike its Greek ancestor, this phase too was surely consciously planned. We might term it an institutionalized trance image, since it derives from an effect which originally was surely unforeseen. Here, however, we meet a further problem. How did the Greek sculptors come to interpret the foliage on top of their grave steles as resembling a human face? A stele, that is, an upright slab or pillar of stone, evokes the image of a standing figure. It is an elementary kind of statue, you might say, and its upper terminus, especially when enriched with decoration, tends to assume the function of a head. We can, if we wish, claim that this notion was unconsciously present in the mind of the carver, and that it accounts for the physiognomic quality of the Acanthus scrolls that you saw a moment ago. But that would be attributing a teleological aspect to what, in the beginning at least, must have been purely fortuitous. I prefer to think that the first Greek who recognized a face in these convolutions was rather taken aback by his discovery. For evidence of another kind of image made by chance in classical art, we must turn to early medieval manuscript illumination. The Gospel book from Saint-Médard in Soissons, produced during the early years of the reign of Charlemagne at the end of the 8th century, includes a number of architecturally framed canon tables, such as the example which I shall now show you on the screen. A canon table is simply a sort of concordance that relates equivalent passages from the Gospels to each other. The vertical divisions are formed by columns of vividly patterned colored marble, and among these striations we find a number of tiny faces. Some are so casual that we wonder whether they are actually present, such as the example that you now see on the screen, but others are clearly intentional. Here is another detail. What is their purpose? How did they get there? Are they institutionalized trance images like the leaf masks? If so, it ought to be possible to find more heads of this sort in other manuscripts. But they seem to occur only on a few pages of the Gospels from Saint-Médard, where they remained unnoticed until just a few years ago. To put faces into painted marble veining, then, was apparently not an established habit among Carolingian illuminators. Are we to assume that the unknown artist who did these canon tables invented this odd little game? Perhaps he spontaneously discovered the semblance of a face among a group of striations while he was painting them. And bemused by its unexpected presence, he elaborated a bit on the quasi-image to make it more definite, and then repeated the same process in more conscious fashion. He knew, of course, that a convincing piece of imitation marble graining must not follow a regular predetermined pattern. Our miniaturist clearly was trying to achieve a casual, random effect when he found that he had made a little head. He may thus have been in somewhat the same position as the action painter of our cartoon, who also aimed at a random effect but produced Whistler's mother instead. But what connection do these faces have with ancient art? The miniaturist in question was surely a man of exceptional individuality. Yet he lived and worked in the context of that classical revival so characteristic of the time of Charlemagne. His canon tables, including the colored marble graining of the columns, are modeled on early Christian manuscripts, which in turn reflected the pictorial traditions of ancient art. It may very well be, therefore, that the little heads nestling in the marble were present in one of these older manuscripts, and that the Carolingian painter inherited the practice instead of discovering it independently. Ancient painting, as we know it from the excavations at Pompeii, Herculaneum, and numerous other sites, includes vast quantities of imitation marble surfaces done with great skill and the prerequisite degree of randomness. I'm showing you here one of the most famous ensembles of Roman painting, the main room in the so-called Villa dei Misteri in Pompeii. And if you look carefully at the areas below and above the main area with the figures in it, you find that there you have these very convincingly painted imitation marble surfaces. For all we know, there may be countless heads and other chance images hidden in all this marble graining. So far, however, no archaeologist has bothered to look for them, even though an interest in such configurations is attested by various classical authors. Thus, Pliny tells us of a certain agate owned by Pyrrhus, on which could be seen Apollo with his lyre and the nine muses, each with a proper attribute, rendered not by art, but by nature through the pattern of the spots. And he also tells us of a picture of Silenus found inside a block of marble that had been split open with wedges. Stories of this sort persisted throughout the Middle Ages and were still given credence by some scholars as late as the 17th century. I'd like to show you a rather amusing example of the persistence of this tradition. This is a woodcut from a 15th century book, a treatise on the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin. Now, the author, in order to make the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin plausible, compares it to various apparently miraculous but actually natural events that he finds reported in ancient and medieval authors. And one of these is the splitting open of a piece of marble that reveals suddenly a head inside the block. That is what the 15th century woodcut designer has tried to illustrate. Inasmuch as these mirabilia could even be cited in theological arguments such as the one I have just mentioned, it is not altogether impossible that the faces on the columns of our gospel book were created quite deliberately so as to characterize the material as miraculous or uniquely precious and hence worthy to frame the word of the Lord. Now, the classical tradition of naturalistic marble graining did not survive for long beyond Carolingian art. From the 10th century until about 1300, such textures were rendered as regular striped patterns that provided no hiding places for secondary images. It is one of the many achievements of Giotto to have rediscovered the ancient technique. He probably studied these imitation marble surfaces in Rome, which at that time contained a great many more remnants of ancient wall painting than we find there today. Giotto's interest in such textures must have been threefold. He was fascinated by their realism because at a distance of a few feet, they were practically indistinguishable from the real thing. He saw them as an aspect of ancient painting that ought to be recaptured in the general context of the revival of antiquity, which had been gathering force in Italy ever since the mid-13th century. And he wondered, we may assume, how on earth the ancient painters had worked these miracles. What unorthodox methods, long since forgotten, did they employ? Did they perhaps actually throw sponges to achieve the necessary random effect? Be that as it may, the earliest imitation marble surfaces equal to those of ancient painting make their appearance soon after 1300 in the frescoes and panels of Giotto. Well, obviously the slide on your left is a detail from the one on your right, but you see it is not a macroscopic detail, but roughly 15% of the total painted surface. Yet this area of imitation marble is so vivid and imaginative that if you look at it by itself, you might almost mistake it for something by Jackson Pollock. In fact, it constitutes an important pictorial element in its own right. These boldly handled swirls and streaks stand out as islands of spontaneity among the smooth, meticulously modeled shapes of Giotto's art. Even technically, they must have been achieved by very different means, possibly with the aid of rags or sponges soaked in color, or in the case of panel painting, through the use of oil. Here on the left side of the screen, you see a detail from the famous Giotto Virgin and Child enthroned in the Uffizi. There are a series of steps leading up to the throne, on either side a kneeling angel. And if you look at the steps and then at the detail on your right, you see that here too you have one of those extraordinary imitation marble surfaces. Now, I don't see how Giotto could have achieved this by means of tempera, which is the painting technique he uses in the rest of the panel. And I hope that one day, maybe, I can persuade the authorities to take a microscopic sample from this area to see whether maybe Giotto used oils in that particular field. And that would then be the earliest instance of the use of oil technique to achieve something that could be done only in oil but not in other media. No hidden images have yet been discovered in the marble graining of Giotto or the countless later artists who profited from his example. Nevertheless, these surfaces could at times achieve an expressive significance quite beyond their usual limited role as realistic decoration. The most spectacular instance occurs in The Last Supper by Andrea del Castagno, one of the masterpieces of the Florentine early Renaissance. Of the six marble panels on the back wall, five are subdued in color and texture, while the third from the left shows a design so aggressively vivid that we hesitate to accept it as a plausible imitation of such a surface. What is its purpose? Why did the artist disrupt the sequence of the panels at this particular point? Although he was one of the pioneers of the new painting style that had been created a generation earlier by Masaccio, Castagno here still follows medieval precedent in placing Christ and the disciples all on the far side of the table, with the single exception of Judas, who alone occupies the near side. The problem was how to draw the beholder's attention to the principal figures in this long and uniform series. Leonardo da Vinci solved the problem 40 years later by putting Christ in the exact center, symmetrically flanked on either side by two groups of three disciples each. Castagno, who did not yet dare to depart from the traditional arrangement, had to use a more subjective method. He made the marble graining above the heads of Christ, Saint Peter, and Judas, an unmistakable signal that attracts our attention to the focus of the drama. Now, could he have thought of this device before he was actually at work on this particular section of the mural? I don't think so, since the paneling is painted in the same free and spontaneous technique so characteristic of Giotto's marble surfaces. Nor does the device occur in any other work. Here, then, we witness what you might call a sudden burst of the imagination set off by the painting of random forms. Meanwhile, however, the early Renaissance had brought about a radically new understanding of the significance of chance effects for artistic creation. In the opening sentences of his treatise on sculpture, written about 1430, the great humanist Leone Battista Alberti describes the origin of sculpture in the following way. those who were inclined to represent the bodies brought forth by nature would at times observe in tree trunks, clumps of earth, or other objects of this sort, certain outlines which, through some slight changes, could be made to resemble a natural shape. They thereupon took thought and tried by adding or taking away here and there to render the resemblance complete. In other words, according to Alberti, the earliest sculptors spontaneously discovered representational meanings in chance formations such as tree trunks, and then made them explicit by adding or taking away. Before long, Alberti continues, these primeval artists learned how to make images without depending on chance resemblances latent in their raw material. Here, for the first time in history, the creative process is described as a reading or projecting of images into random shapes. And the quality of imagination needed to do this is proclaimed as the special talent that sets the artist apart from the layman. No ancient author had been able to see this relationship. Imagination, or fantasia, to use the Greek term, was regarded as the common property of all men. And the only classical theory explaining the origin of art did so purely in terms of imitation. The first artist was he who drew a line around a shadow cast by the face of a person. For us, the choice between this imitation theory and Alberti's view is an easy one. The process Alberti described has been verified by students of Stone Age and prehistoric art. And I'd like to show you a rather interesting example. These are two racially pure Germanic tree gods that were dug up some 20 years ago in a peat bog on the Danish-German border. They date from around the time of Christ, and obviously the sculptor here has simply taken two tree trunks, upended them, used the first fork as the legs, and then carved the lower portion of the trunk into a face. They are quite big. The male god is over 3 meters tall. It's a shame that Hitler didn't live long enough to have this evidence of what racially pure Germanic art looks like. It is really true that various inventions are seen in such a stain. But although those stains give you inventions, they will not teach you to finish any detail. This painter of whom I have spoken makes very dull landscapes. Apparently, Leonardo here records an experience he had about 1480, shortly before his departure for Milan. Botticelli, then at the height of his career, plays the role of an anti-Protogenes, whose views Leonardo turns to his own advantage. In a later passage, Leonardo recommends that painters look for landscapes as well as figure compositions in the accidental patterns of stained walls, varicolored stones, ashes, clouds, or similar things, which he compares to the sound of bells in whose pealing you can find every name and word you can imagine. It would be fascinating to know whether Leonardo practiced what he preached. If he did, no evidence has survived among his known works. Perhaps he covered his tracks so well in the process of what he calls finishing the detail that we are no longer able to recognize the origin of chance images in his work. Yet we have at least one instance of a picture, not by Leonardo to be sure, but by a follower of Leonardo, that gives us some idea of how this phenomenon might work in practice. This is a large altarpiece, a Virgin with Saints, now in the Denver, Colorado Art Museum. It's, of course, inspired by a famous picture of Leonardo's, the Madonna of the Rocks, except that the setting of these figures is not a natural cave, but a decaying classical building. And if you look in the upper left-hand corner of the picture, of which I'm showing you an enlarged detail on the other screen, You note that among these crumbling blocks of stone, there certainly is a face with a rather long mustache, a short beard, and a broad hat. Now, this face has absolutely nothing to do with the official subject matter of the picture. It is something that apparently came about because the artist had been alerted to the possibility of trans images to be found in crumbling walls and similar phenomena that Leonardo had enumerated. So he was having a bit of fun with his own work. And of course, the face is so discreet that only if you look for it will you become aware of it. And the conventionally pious beholder will simply skip it because he doesn't think that such a thing might exist in an altarpiece. Leonardo's ideas also influenced some of his Florentine contemporaries, such as Piero di Cosimo, who, according to Vasari, was in the habit of staring at clouds and spotted walls, imagining that he saw there equestrian combats and the most fantastic cities and the grandest landscapes. Piero's picture, The Discovery of Honey, which you now see on the screen in the Worcester, Massachusetts Art Museum, shows an extravagantly shaped willow tree with pronounced trans image features right in the center of the picture. There's an open-mouthed human face, the head of a deer, and similar things. Yet this tree is clearly based on a close study of actual willow trees, which the artist must have gone out of his way to find. Nor was he the only one to take delight in such formations. There's a recently discovered sketchbook by his contemporary Fra Bartolomeo, which includes a drawing of an old mulberry tree with equally grotesque and suggestive shapes. Now, Piero di Cosimo's reported habit of seeking images in clouds has ample precedence in classical literature. Unstable and shifting figures to be seen in clouds are mentioned by numerous Greek and Roman authors. The phenomenon was so well known, in fact, that it became a rhetorical commonplace. Even in the Middle Ages, when Anselm of Canterbury compares certain arguments to figments painted on clouds, and the Byzantine scholar Michael Psellos explains that demons can change their shape as easily as clouds, which may resemble men, bears, dragons, and so forth. Yet none of these authors approached Alberti's insight into trans images as the starting point of artistic creation. They may concede that it is our imagination which interprets the random shapes of clouds and endows them with representational values, but they do not claim that artists have this faculty to a greater degree than others. What sets the artist apart is not his capacity to form mental images, but his ability to reproduce these images manually. Thus, ancient painters, unlike Piero di Cosimo, could not be expected to seek artistic inspiration by staring at clouds. Nor did they show any interest in clouds, for the skies and the murals of Pompeii and Herculaneum are almost invariably cloudless. When in early Christian times clouds became an important feature of Western art, they did so as carriers of religious meaning, subject to well-established formal conventions. Not until the 15th century did painters explore cloud formations for their own sake, as part of the visible world of everyday experience. And it is here that we find the beginnings of another institutionalized trans image. The earliest examples of image-bearing clouds, dating from about 1460, are so casual and inconspicuous as to suggest creation at the spur of the moment. Here is such an example. The painting here is The Birth of the Virgin by the master of the Barberini panels in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. There's a tiny cloud which has been made to resemble the head of a dolphin emerging from the water. Now again, of course, this dolphin, at least at first glance, has no connection whatsoever with the official subject of the picture. And yet, we may perhaps be able to suggest why the artist in this case made this dolphin visible instead of wiping it away, which was certainly his option once he saw that the cloud that he had been painting began to look like a dolphin. If you look at the picture as a whole, you realize that the artist has gone to great lengths to place the event in an authentic classical setting. He says this is an event that takes place in the ancient classical world. The building is composed of the elements of ancient architecture. There are lots of reliefs on the building and so forth. But at the same time, the artist wanted to alert the beholder to the fact that this is not just the birth of any old baby, but this is a very special birth that was to be of great consequences for humanity. And I think at this point, he remembered about the ancient habits of reading the future in such phenomena as the flight of birds or the shape of clouds. And you notice that right next to the dolphin, there is indeed a flight of birds, a V-shaped flight of birds. And I think that must be a reference to the old tradition of augury, which of course no one knew how to practice any longer in the 15th century, but about which they knew from classical authors. Now the dolphin is also, of course, a very good animal. In classical tradition, it has only favorable connotations. So that a cloud looking like a dolphin is a fitting accompaniment to a favorable flight of birds, and the two together tip off the learned beholder that this is the birth of a very important child. Now here is another phenomenon of the same sort, roughly contemporary with the birth of the Virgin that we have just seen. This is Mantegna's painting of Saint Sebastian in Vienna, where a cloud in the upper left-hand corner contains the figure of a horseman. Now you will notice that it is not really a complete horseman, but only part of a horseman. The rear part has not been added because that might disrupt the shape of the cloud. And of course, it's again a tiny portion of the total painting. When scholars first became aware of this little horseman, they said, now what could that possibly have to do with the subject of Saint Sebastian? And they looked at all the legends that are connected with Saint Sebastian and never came to a conclusion. We can only say, well, this horseman is there because in the process of painting, Mantegna happened to realize that he had made something that looked like a horseman. And at that point, again, he had the option. Do I leave it there? Do I elaborate upon it so that other people can see it too? Or do I simply wipe it out? Now, it so happens that this painting must have been made for a very learned patron, because it's the only painting where Mantegna's signature appears in Greek. Mantegna himself was a learned artist, following the new ideal of the educated artist rather than the craftsman. And he was here apparently catering to the learning of the particular individual for whom he was doing the picture. And he thus could assume that the patron was familiar with these classical references to images in clouds, and when he had made an image in the cloud, he said, now, he may enjoy this, I'll discreetly reinforce it, just enough so that he will be aware of it, but not to the point where it really clashes with the main subject of the picture. Now, Mantegna himself later on institutionalized the discovery that we have just witnessed. What began as a sort of visual pun of semi-private character soon became an established method for the representation of incorporeal beings, such as the wind gods that you see among the clouds in the detail from a late work of the artist. We can also find it in the Madonna by Raphael on your left, where you see how clouds turn into angels and angels turn back into clouds. And finally, in that splendid painting on your right, that is Correggio's Jupiter and Io, where Jupiter envelops the swooning Io in the shape of a cloud. This is a classical myth that no ancient artist had been able to represent, because they didn't know how to make a Jupiter that appears to Io in the shape of a cloud. Correggio knew, because he had been a disciple of Mantegna. Even the human soul, hitherto represented as a small human figure, but with all the substance of living flesh, could now become a cloudy ectoplasmic shape, as you can see in this famous work by El Greco. The angel in the center of the burial of Count Orgaz, which I'm showing you in the detail on the right-hand side of the screen, carries this cloudy little being, which is the soul of Count Orgaz being carried to heaven. And in fact, cloud images of various kinds have survived right into modern times. Here is a rather attractive picture by the American late 19th century painter Elihu Vedder, which is at first glance nothing more than an evening seascape. But then you begin to be aware that there's a mysterious woman's face appearing among the clouds, and that adds another dimension to such a picture. And we even find it among contemporary comic strips. This requires no commentary on my part. No, I'm sorry, it's the other screen. There is the third frame. The new concern with accidental images in both theory and practice that we have just surveyed reflects a growing self-awareness among artists of the 15th century that can be found not only in Italy, but north of the Alps as well. Albrecht Dürer reveals this attitude from the very beginning of his career in his numerous and psychologically fascinating self-portraits, such as the pen drawing of 1493, now on the screen, which shows the 22-year-old artist's face, a sketch of his left hand, and a pillow on one side of the sheet. But on the back of the same sheet, we find six more studies of pillows. And this has always seemed rather puzzling, because why should Dürer want to draw that many pillows? If he simply wanted to study a pillow because he needed one for a woodcut or engraving he was working on, one or two should be quite sufficient. But here we have actually seven. Well, it turns out that there's a hidden relationship between these pillows and the self-portrait. For the pillows, too, are exercises in physiognomy. What interested Dürer was the way the folds could suggest human faces. Now, note especially the pillow in the lower left-hand corner, which he has interpreted as a bearded Turk with a huge turban. And apparently, he played this game with the same pillow a number of times. He would pick it up, throw it down, look for a face, then he would pick it up, throw it down again, make another drawing. If I had time to turn this slide around in a number of ways so as to point out all the faces to you, I would be happy to do that, but I think maybe one example will have to do. The pillows here then have the same function as the foliage, clouds, tree trunk, and marble veinings we have encountered earlier. To all appearances, Dürer discovered the image-bearing potential of pillows quite independently and by accident. In any event, the drawing antedates his first trip to Italy, so that he could not yet have known of Alberti's, Leonardo's, or Mantegna's interest in chance images. In subsequent years, he may well have become acquainted with their ideas on the subject, But his own writings give no hint of any concern with chance images as a source of artistic endeavor. The physiognomic pillows of 1493 never reached the institutionalized stage. Now there is, interestingly enough, a northern medieval tradition that already points in the direction of this pillow game that Dürer was playing, and I'd like to show you a couple of examples of this. Here is a German 13th century miniature. You see the whole page on your left, showing the birth of Christ. Now if you concentrate on the lower right-hand corner, with the sleeping Joseph on the ground, you find that among the rocks and foliage on the ground, there are a number of faces. These faces are, of course, related to the leaf masks that we have come to know before. Here is an artist who takes the spontaneous opportunity to convert these formations on the ground into faces that have no business being there, unless we are to assume that he wants to hint at earth demons and dark forces of that sort, which are, of course, pushed aside or superseded by the birth of the infant Christ. And here is a second example that comes a little closer to Dürer's own time. This is from a very beautiful Netherlandish manuscript painted in the middle years of the 15th century. The painter, whose name we do not know, specializes in these very realistic marginal decorations. On this page, the ornamentation consists of strawberry vines with butterflies. Now, a lepidopterist could identify each one of the specimens of butterflies that the artist had put in here, except for the one in the upper left-hand corner, of which I'm showing you a detail, because that butterfly suddenly has a wing on which there appears a skull, a threatening death head. Now I suspect, since there is no butterfly which actually has this pattern, that our artist accidentally made such a head or something that suggested a death head to him, and then he again was faced with the question, do I leave it there, do I elaborate upon it so that others can see it as well, or do I wipe it out? And he must have figured, well now, after all, the butterfly is a symbol for the brevity of human life, so combining a death head with the wing of a butterfly makes a very striking symbol, a very striking memento mori, which is of course a subject that everyone in the North in the 15th century was very much aware of. So that he decided to not only keep this skull, but to make it explicit enough for others to observe it as well. The chance images we have discussed so far all have one feature in common. The artist finds them, or pretends to find them, among the random shapes of the outside world. He does not create them, but merely discovers them, and makes the resemblance more complete, as Alberti puts it, while leaving the identity of the matrix, foliage, veined marble, clouds, tree trunks, pillows, butterflies, unchanged. This limitation may help to explain why Leonardo's advice to painters, even though enshrined in the text of his treatise on painting, had little practical effect until the dawn of the modern era. In 1785 to 86, the English landscape painter and drawing teacher Alexander Cousins published an illustrated treatise entitled A New Method of Assisting the Invention in Drawing Original Compositions of Landscape, and describing a mechanical method to draw forth the ideas of artists. This method consists of making casual and largely accidental ink blots on a paper with a brush. to serve as the store of compositional suggestions. And this is one of the illustrations from the treatise. Once the blots have been made, Cousins calls them a production of chance with a small degree of design. The artist is to place a piece of transparent paper over them and make a selective tracing, being careful to preserve the spirit of the blot by not adding anything that is not suggested by the blots underneath. Cousins cites Leonardo's words about the images to be seen on dirty walls and so forth, but adds proudly that he thinks his procedure an improvement since it permits the artist to produce chance images at will, without having to seek them out in the world of nature. Actually, the difference between the two methods is far more important than that. Cousins' inkblot landscapes are not works of nature in which the artist's imagination discovers unexpected random images, but works of art. However spontaneous or undisciplined, they are landscapes of a sort from the very beginning, displaying a highly individual graphic rhythm, if nothing else. The purpose of his method, Cousins makes clear, is to free the artist from involuntary servitude to conventional patterns of landscape composition by making him relinquish deliberate control of his movements as much as possible in the beginning. The selective tracing of the blots is intended to redress the balance. To his contemporaries, however, designs such as the sample on the screen seemed sheer chaos, and the blot master was subjected to endless ridicule. Yet this very notoriety kept the Cousins method from being forgotten. Its liberating effect on Constable and Turner must have been profound. We even find it somewhat belatedly in America. Here is a piece, a blotscape by Thomas Moran, a landscapist of otherwise no very great distinction, who would on occasion produce things of this sort, which have an extraordinary evocative power. That the Cousins method anticipated a general trend toward free, spontaneous brushwork, transcribing the artist's creative impulse more directly than before, is amusingly attested by a French cartoon of 1844, which shows the painters of the Romantic school with Delacroix in the foreground as simian virtuosi who do not even look at their canvases as they paint. The Cousins method also seems to be the ancestor of the Rorschach inkblot test. A parlor game based on it enjoyed a certain vogue in early 19th century England and may have inspired the German physician and romantic poet Justinus Kerner, who in the 1850s produced something that he called Klexographien, blotographs. These are inkblots on folded paper, which he modified slightly to emphasize the chance images he found in them, in this case, a little devil. He wrote descriptive poems based on these images and collected his material to be published, but the publication only happened near the end of the 19th century, so that the belated rediscovery of Justinus Kerner's blotographs makes it likely that they were known to Hermann Rorschach, who used the same folded paper technique for his tests, but substituted oral for graphic interpretation of the images. We are now prepared to take a closer look at Whistler's libel suit against Ruskin, an event that served to focus public attention on an attitude toward trance effects far more radical than that of Alexander Cousins. Ruskin had charged Whistler with flinging a pot of paint in the public's face on the basis of such pictures as Nocturne in Black and Gold, The Falling Rocket, which you now see on the screen, painted in the early 1870s. The phrase would be understandable had it been coined by an advocate of the conservative style derived from neoclassicism, but Ruskin was a great admirer of William Turner, whose later canvases are often as lacking in descriptive precision as Whistler's own. Here is an example of a late Turner, and I think there's little to choose between the two from this particular perspective. Why then Ruskin's sudden fury? Apparently what Ruskin resented was not so much the way Whistler's pictures looked as the basic attitude behind them. Turner had habitually endowed his works with elaborate literary titles, often adding long quotations from ancient or modern authors that showed, that told the beholder how to read the picture. Whistler, in contrast, believed, though he did not always practice what he preached, that the subject of a painting was of no importance in itself. To him, it was little more than a peg on which to hang attractive combinations of form and color. In order to stress his conviction that descriptive values in paintings were as secondary as they were in music, Whistler, from the early 1860s on, liked to call his works symphonies, harmonies, nocturnes, or arrangements, with the subject proper mentioned only in second place as a concession to the ignorant public. It was this aestheticism, this reduction of painting to values of form and color, that Ruskin rejected as fundamentally immoral. And society agreed with him. Whistler won the suit, but was awarded only a farthing in damages, perhaps because he had stated his aim with such extraordinary candor. In painting a nocturne, Whistler said, I have meant to indicate an artistic interest alone, divesting the picture from any outside sort of interest which might have otherwise been attached to it. It is an arrangement of line, form, and color first, and I make use of any incident, by which he means accident, which shall bring forth a symmetrical, that is, a harmonious result. In The Falling Rocket, more than in any other picture, Whistler did indeed divest his work of outside interest to such a degree that without the aid of the subtitle, we might be hard put to recognize the scene. How much accident went into the painting of it is impossible to say, because we are now approaching the point where chance and intention become inseparable. Unlike Cousins, who still wanted his blots to yield recognizable images, Whistler solicits chance effects for the sake of what he calls symmetry. Representation, taken for granted as the aim of art from the beginning of time, is about to give way to a new primary reality, that of the brushstroke itself. And when this happens, we lose the frame of reference that had enabled us to differentiate between accident and purpose before. The non-figurative art of our own time, ruled by the muse of chance, is strikingly forecast in Whistler's thinking. Is present-day art perhaps too accident-prone? The issue was posed in rather disturbing fashion some years ago, when Betsy, a young female chimpanzee at the Baltimore Zoo, was provided with artist materials and made to compete with avant-garde painters. Now, apes had been drawing and painting for the benefit of experimental psychologists ever since the time of the First World War. But Betsy's predecessors attracted little attention in non-scientific circles, since nobody could seriously claim that their efforts resembled those of modern artists. By 1957, such a confrontation no longer seemed quite too far-fetched. Modern art had, as it were, caught up, or according to some, converged with that of the ape. Actually, the occasion was the acquisition by the Baltimore Museum of an abstract expressionist work, which you now see on the screen, confronted with that of Betsy. And I leave it to you to decide which is which. Needless to say, the conservatives were jubilant. For the past 100 years, they had inveighed against the incompetence of modern artists, with the claim that any child can do better than that. Now they could say the same of the infrahuman primates. The friends of Moranard found this new attack rather more difficult to cope with than the earlier ones. To the charge that Moranard was childish, they had found an effective answer. The pictures made by small children were, after all, quote, creative, hence authentic works of art unspoiled by convention. And the convergence of avant-garde and children's art must therefore be welcomed as a return to the wellsprings of creativity, or some other beautiful phrase of that kind. Could the same argument be extended to the apes? Did their pictures too deserve to be termed works of art? Since apes can draw or paint only with man-made materials, on man-made surfaces, and under human stimulus and supervision, it might be thought that they act merely as tools for the production of random designs, like the proverbial brush tied to a donkey's tail. And because these designs are, after all, selected and interpreted not by the tool, but by human beholders, who are likely to do so on the basis of aesthetic judgments derived from their familiarity with modern art, they might be called works of art in the same sense as the objet trouvé of the Dadaists, that is, common household things creatively selected for exhibition. This